So good evening, everyone. Here and there and everywhere. I hope you got some sunshine today. Wasn't that great? So this is the second week of this Dharma seminar series I'm calling What Does Love Have to Do with Zen? And last week's talk should be posted on the website, I think, by now, if you would like to catch up. But briefly, we looked at last week that the many different kinds of love, romantic, filial, do you know what filial love is? A child feels filial love for their parents, we hope. Parental love, grandparental, self-love, codependent love, altruistic love, love of God, love from God, if you relate to God as such, unconditional and conditional love, and more. We also looked at ways the word love has been used in traditional Buddhist and Zen contexts, and we'll touch on that as we go along through these weeks. But my question, you know, what does love have to do with Zen, originally came, of course, because the word love doesn't appear that often in Zen texts or in the koan literature. But when I searched the whole two-volume long text by Dogen Zenji, the Shobo Genzo, I actually found quite a few examples. And then I mentioned last week, of course, even if the word love isn't used, the word heart is used a lot, often in combination with another character or word. So in a way, our whole practice is about, I mean, Bodhisattva is the heart and mind, heart-mind in one, of the Bodhisattva. So our whole practice is in sensing about the heart and mind as one. And last week we also looked at some definitions, sort of contemporary definitions of love, but love in a broad sense. And the one that that I like, one of the ones, is from John Wellwood, who wrote, he's a psychotherapist who writes, has written a lot about integrating psychology and spirituality, and particularly in terms of relationships. So perfect love, imperfect relationships, that pretty much describes our predicament, doesn't it? Healing the Wound of the Heart is his subtitle. And it's quite a good book. I do recommend it. And his definition of love is the feeling of openness and warmth which allows us to make real contact, to take delight in and appreciate, and to be at one with ourselves, others, and life itself. So it's a feeling of warmth and connection, right? So that's similar to the sense of the meaning of metta or loving kindness in Buddhist practice. It's often described as unconditional friendliness and goodwill. And last week I mentioned the great Vietnamese Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who died recently. In his book, Teachings on Love, he maintains that not only metta or loving kindness, but the whole, all four of what are called the Brahma Viharas or noble abodes, so which are loving kindness, metta, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy, and upekkha, equanimity, that the whole package is how we express our capacity for love fully. And I really like that sense that it takes all of them. And those are actual practices that we can cultivate. And last week, I introduced the practice of forgiveness, which is classically done before starting metta or loving kindness practice, as a way to begin opening the heart. And it occurred to me, I gave you some phrases for forgiveness practice last week, and I think I will type them up and post them on the website posting for this series so people can, because I saw people trying to take notes last week. So I'll put some PDFs on the website of these phrases for the Brahma Viharas. I don't know if any of you have ever noticed that sometimes it's harder to forgive yourself than to forgive others. Yeah, I have noticed that, and that kind of harshness we have towards ourselves is why we start, when we do metta or loving kindness as a meditation, why it's traditional to start with the self. It's a kind of truism that you can't fully love others if you can't fully love yourself, right? I'm sure you've heard this before. But I would be cautious about saying you have to be able to love yourself before you can love others, as though somehow you're disqualified from being a loving person if you experience any self-hatred or self-criticism. Because that's not very helpful, is it, to feel like you're disqualified as a loving person? So I think most of us do experience bouts, if not deep times of self-criticism, even self-loathing at times. But to say that you can't express love until you are fully free of that, it's sort of like saying you have to be a fully realized, selfless, compassionate bodhisattva before you can be of any benefit in the world. And that's not how it works. It really isn't how it works. Our bodhisattva practice is to live in this world just as it is, as the world is, as we are, and to shine the light of awareness on suffering, our suffering, other suffering, the roots of our suffering, and allow that very awareness to open the heart of compassion. So it's our own pain that allows our hearts to open to others. And yes, our self-hatred and our self-criticism does impair our capacity for loving others. Sometimes severely, sometimes subtly, right? But I would like to suggest that expanding our capacity for self-love and love of others is synergistic. We learn to love others by loving ourselves. We learn to love ourselves by loving others. I think it works both ways. And I've not really seen this expressed in anything I've read. And it puzzles me. Because I think that's true based on my own experience. I remember when I was probably, I don't know, 20, which is pretty long ago, in my first long-term relationship, when I realized, I had this kind of epiphany, when I realized that my own self-hatred and habits of self-depreciation, deprecation, I mean, and self-judgment, were actually hurting my partner and our relationship. And I saw that I needed to question, look at my habit patterns and where they came from, and I didn't really understand or have a whole lot of insight, but that was my motivation to look, because I could see it was harming. So, you know, I think it works both ways. And I think although our love for others is often contaminated by our own self-interest, sure, by our desires and our fears and our wishes for the other person to be different and love us the way we want them to. But most often at the core of our love for someone else is something pure, something that regards them with deep care and warmth. And we do love them for who they are, if they would just stack the dishwasher right, or pay attention when we're trying to talk to them. Both are true, right? Both are true. That there's a sincere, deep, warm regard, and, you know, it's sort of like the famous line that Suzuki Roshi told his students, "You are all perfect just as you are, and you could all use a little improvement." That's, you know, that's our human koan. But going back to the question of self-love, we're not talking about narcissism or selfishness, but a love that is even-handed, recognizing that the self and other are both worthy of love, are both and ultimately not separate. The Buddha himself said, "You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection." And Dogen, who founded our school of Zen, said, "Love and respect your body, mind, and self that are engaged in this continuous practice." So you have, you know, care for yourself, care for your body, mind, spirit. Support yourself to do this practice. So how do we learn to love ourselves, and how did we learn to hate ourselves? You know, how do little children learn to hate themselves? Isn't that sad? And it happens, doesn't it? So I want to draw a little bit on a book that I found absolutely fascinating and very insightful, called The Neuroscience of Human Relationships, Attachment and the Developing Social Brain. Louis Cozzolino, clinical psychologist and specializing in neuroscience. He describes how early relationships shape our neurological development in infancy and early childhood in ways that affect our future relationships. And in his introduction, he says this: like every living system, from single neurons to complex ecosystems, the brain depends on interactions with others for its survival. Each brain is dependent on the scaffolding of caretakers and loved ones for its survival, growth, and well-being. The brain is an organ of adaptation that builds its structures through interactions with others. We could say, we could say our brain is structured by our interactions with the whole world, not only with people, right? But with the birds and the trees. I know that was true for me as a little girl. So then he says, there are no single brains, right? That's just like the Buddhist insight of no separate self. He says, no single brains. We are always, our very neural networks develop in relationship. From the moment a child is born, they begin to interact with their environment, right? Most particularly with their mother or whoever else becomes the primary caregiver. And as time goes by, with other close caregivers and others. The parts of the brain that process facial recognition and facial expression begin to develop very early, and the neurological circuits involved in what are called mirror and resonance systems. These systems involve what are called mirror neurons. This has become more well known than when he first wrote this book. You know what it feels like when you have a startle response, or there's somebody in a movie has a startle response and you startle too, right? Or you startle and then I startle. Or if I yawn and then you yawn, right? I could do it right now.
No.
Mirror neurons, that's mirror neurons. And they're also called resonance behaviors. Neuroscientists speculate that these systems are involved in all kinds of social functions, such as learning, understanding nonverbal language cues, facial expressions, and ultimately the capacity for empathy, for that kind of attunement to others, for receiving and giving care and affection. And these systems probably evolved very, very early in our development as human animals, before we even had speech, because we communicated through gesture and facial expression, just like chimpanzees do, right? And sound, right? Very expressive faces if you look at chimps, and gesture. So they, you know, mirror neurons started before we were even human, most likely. And right within, from the very earliest times, an infant begins to gaze at the mother's face and track her movements and respond to her facial expressions, voice, and touch. All that sort of, you know, goo-goo, gaga, kind of back and forth with the mother is building neural circuits in that little brain to form what he calls the social brain. And the richer that interactive environment, the stronger and more complex the neural circuitry will be. And conversely, the more impoverished those interactions, like those little babies raised in orphanages where they're just all lined up and have very little interaction, then the more impoverished their ability to interact and respond in a social environment. And these systems of the social brain also contribute to the ability to regulate affect, regulate like getting the kind of stimulation that threat or alarm causes, and to regulate that. And they create our functional sense of self and other, our ability to form interpersonal relationships that are neither too disengaged nor too enmeshed. You know, what's the right balance? And that have a kind of flexible give and take. We learn that very early, or sometimes don't learn it so well. That the early bonding experience within which this development occurs or fails to occur is often described in terms of what's called attachment theory. So you've probably heard about that if you took any psychology courses in university. And the early research in attachment theory categorizes different ways that little children form attachments to their primary caregiver, and then the implications for these early patterns later on in life. There was a series of classic experiments conducted in 1978 by a child psychologist named Marion Ainsworth, along with her mentor, John Bowlby, who was considered the father of attachment theory. And it was a time when developmental psychologists shifted from kind of abstract Freudian theories to actually observing children, real children. And the experiment was called The Strange Situation. Some of you, I'm sure, have heard of this. A mother and a baby would be put in a room and allowed some time to settle in, and there would be toys in the room. And then a stranger typically one of the researchers, would come into the room and sit down off to the side. And then the mother would go out of the room, leaving the baby there in the room with the stranger for a while. And then they would observe what the baby did. And then the mother would come back. These are babies who were of an age where they, more like toddlers, where they could actively play with the toys if they wanted, or crawl around. And then the mother would come back into the room and sit down where she had been, and the child's response to the mother would be observed. Excuse me. So the researchers identified two basic categories of attachment: secure attachment and insecure attachment. When their mother was present, the securely attached infants would go around the room and play with the toys, kind of ranging out, and then come back to the mom, and then go out and play, and then come back to the mom. And when she left the room, they might protest mildly, but when she returned, they easily reestablish a kind of comfortable connection and keep playing. So that's a secure attachment. And then there are three kinds of insecure attachment. First one's called insecure avoidant babies, would show their insecurity by almost kind of avoiding their mother. And they often don't cry when she leaves and don't really reestablish contact when she returns. It's almost like there isn't a relationship of trust there. They kind of pull into themselves. And then there's insecure ambivalent babies, are likely to cling to the mother and not explore the room, be very upset when she leaves, but then push her away if she tries to comfort them when she comes back. And then the third, which is the least common type, is insecure disorganized babies who become just kind of dazed and disoriented and fearful. So they're not really able to engage with the situation. So further research found correlations between these different types or patterns and the qualities of the caregivers. So securely attached babies tended to have caregivers who were sensitive to and responsive to their needs. And the caregivers of the avoidant babies tended to be kind of just unavailable or rejecting. And the caregivers of the ambivalent babies tended to be inconsistent. So maybe sometimes being very, you know, kind of smothery and sometimes not available. So giving mixed messages. And the disorganized babies often were babies who had experience neglect or abuse. Now, these were not hard and fast correspondences. Children on the autistic spectrum, for example, sometimes are very sensitive to touch and pull back from touch, which is confusing for their parents or caregivers. But that's a little different from what this is talking about. And even more recent research looked at attachment between young children and their fathers or other caregivers, and found that children form quite strong bonds with them as well as with their mothers. And these observations of babies and caregivers suggest how important this kind of secure attachment, which allows this movement, right? Not enmeshed, but allows this free movement, the child's ability to explore the world with some confidence. And there was a correlation between babies with secure attachment later in adolescence generally fared better as they began to form an identity and find their place in the world. And these attachment patterns play out, as you can maybe imagine, when we start to form couple relationships, which we'll talk about in a couple weeks. We're going to get there. They also have found, research has also found correlations between these patterns and the mother's own relationships to their mothers and parents, or parents, at least 75% of the time. But the correlations are not 100%. Because although early childhood is strongly, you know, a strong influence in our lives and in our development, it's not the whole picture. It can be modified by other influences as we grow up. So insecure attachment can be strengthened by loving and caring relationships along the way. We are not, as Freud thought, fully determined, by the time we're four. On the other hand, secure attachment can be jeopardized by sustained abuse or trauma down the road. So the good news is, we are not condemned forever by our early childhood experiences, that we have some choices about how we bring awareness to our own conditioning and patterning, and the brain is an adaptive organ, right? And as we know, it can change even in adulthood. Now, we've been talking about attachment, and you may be wondering, well, isn't Buddhism about non-attachment and no self? Well, someone once quipped, you have to have a self to let go of the self. And it could be argued, as I am arguing, that you have to be able to form a healthy sense of attachment or relationship, connection. If we call it connection rather than attachment, right, we have to be able to form a kind of confident connection with others, to be in relationship with others and to have the capacity to connect and let go. Right? We need to, so that we're not pushing away and we're not clinging. That's the capacity we need to develop. And we do it right here on our seats with our own thoughts. Right? So this is how this all plays out in this theme of our capacity to be in relationship, right? With family, friends, colleagues, strangers, in an open-hearted, open-minded, dynamic way, which is love, right? So next week I want to go on a little bit more into how our self-image is formed in relationship, going further into childhood and mainly with family, but also with our social connections, and how we learn to love and how we learn not to love ourselves and others. What are the impediments? And all this, of course, begs the question, how can deficits in the social brain be healed? Well, Western psychology has been attempting for decades with limited success. And only recently, with a better understanding of the neurobiology of trauma and the importance of working with body and mind together. So I think we are becoming more nuanced in our understanding that talk therapy alone is not enough. Can the capacities we consider normal be enhanced? Can we improve our ability to resonate and attune with others and deepen our capacity for empathy? Can we hope to free our minds to see more clearly, to our hearts to love more fully, and our bodies to convey our authentic experience more joyously? I'd say that this simple practice of mindful awareness is one of the very best ways that we can do that, that we can actualize that aspiration. Mindful awareness along with those practices of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy. As these are experiential practices, they're not just abstractions. And when we change our experience, our direct experience, we change our neurochemistry, which in turn affects our experience. We may never spend years meditating in a cave in the foothills of the Himalayas, but we can nonetheless train our minds and our brains in loving kindness and compassion. And we can use these time-honored teachings of the Buddha to do so. I think the Buddhist meditations on compassion are unrivaled, because Western thinking has, I think, refused this possibility for so long, that these are capacities we can actually cultivate. So we begin with metta, we begin with loving kindness, which is traditionally the first one that's taught, because it kind of softens and opens the heart, expanding our capacity then to turn towards suffering, to open towards compassion. Practicing with compassion for suffering can be very powerful and intense, so that's where the practice of joy and the practice of equanimity comes in to balance it out, because we can be overwhelmed by practicing compassion if we don't have that support of joy and equanimity. So it's traditional to begin metta practice with the self. And traditionally, it would have been, in very traditional Theravadan Buddhism, it's taught as more as a concentration practice, to focus the mind very strongly on this state of loving kindness, almost to achieve a high state of samadhi. But I would like to encourage you to do, when you do this practice, to do it with a little bit more of a Zen inflection. And by that I mean balancing that concentration with mindfulness, with moment-to-moment awareness of mind and body, so that each time we sit down and do metta practice, we're noticing, how do I feel in my body? You know, maybe my heart is not feeling very open, and we don't have to judge that. We just breathe, stay with it, do the practice, feel a little subtle shift. So it's less goal-oriented and more mindfulness-oriented, is what I'd like to suggest. And still very powerful. Unlike regular Zazen practice, how many of you have done some metta practice before? Just about everybody. Yeah, lots over there too. So typically we do it with our eyes closed, unlike Zen practice, and that's so that we can visualize the person we're extending metta to, if we want. So let's do a little bit of that right now. Okay. So get into a comfortable... It's very important when you do these practices to be physically comfortable, to not be in pain. You know, there are times to practice with pain, and you know, but this is not one. When you're, you know, when you're doing metta practice, it's really important for the body to be at ease. So do whatever you need to support your body to be comfortable. And so you can close your eyes. And bring your attention to the area of your heart. And just breathe in and out from there. You can even put your hand over your heart if you like, so you can feel more connected to it, to that area. And just notice any feelings of contraction or openness, warmth, movement. And just kind of be present to yourself, you know, let your day kind of settle into you. And then I'm just going to read some of the traditional possible phrases that you can use in this practice. And what you do is repeat those phrases silently to yourself, usually just about three, on the rhythm of your breath. You know, so you might breathe in and then breathe out, "May I be happy." Breathe in and out, "May I be safe from harm." "May I be well in body and mind." "May my heart be at ease." And then if there's some feeling of distress or anxiety, some kind of suffering present, it's fine also to extend into a feeling of compassion for yourself. And it's okay to use phrases like, "May I be free from fear." "May I be free from sorrow." These are just a few possibilities. So let's just take just a few minutes more to just sit in presence. You know, we don't have time to do much, but see what phrases are the best for you right now, today. Some people doing this practice find the words a little bit too intrusive or entangling. So it's okay to let the words become very quiet or even fade into just a felt sense of warmth and kindness and a kind of curiosity, warm interest and curiosity in your own experience, as though you were being a very kind mentor to yourself, someone in that role. you are when you do this practice, kind of befriending yourself. And if it's really hard to befriend yourself as you are right now, it's really helpful to picture yourself as a young child. You can go back as far as you need to. You could be a newborn or just a little baby, or you could be 3 or 4 or 6 or 10. And see if you can give yourself that kind attention and interest that you would offer to a child that age. So just to close this very short little metta meditation, I'm going to read you some phrases from Thich Nhat Hanh. May I learn to look at myself with the eyes of understanding and love. May I be able to recognize and touch the seeds of joy and happiness in myself. May I learn to identify and see the sources of anger, craving, and delusion in myself. Okay, so I'm gonna, I don't have a bell to ring, but ding. Thank you for trying that just that short little time. And I really want to encourage you this coming week, each day, to do even a little bit of metta practice for yourself. And work with the phrases. You know, you can be creative about this. You don't have to use a formula. I just gave you some possibilities. And it doesn't have to be limited to formal meditation. You can do what I call spot metta or street metta. Which means when you become aware that you need a little love, stop and pause and breathe and give yourself a little love. I mean, it sounds funny, but I'm serious, right? Just bring to mind one of those phrases that's just going to shift things just a little bit for you and see how that works. Okay, so we're not going to get in small groups because I've talked too long. Not only that, what I'd like to do when we do our introduction round is for each person to offer one phrase that maybe you just came up with. Say it as may I, whatever. Doesn't matter if you duplicate somebody else's. Choose one that you'd like to just say out loud, you know. And you're then going to give everybody a whole collection of metta phrases to take home. Okay, one from each of you. Okay? I mean, you don't have to. It's just my idea. But we're going to do the round anyway, right? So let's...